Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Last week, Governor Jerry Brown declared a drought emergency. While the unusually sunny weather here makes for a pleasant winter in the Bay Area, the lack of precipitation is generating some grim statistics. As you may have heard, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, 94% of California is in a drought. The Sierra snowpack is only 13% of normal, and 2013 was California's driest year on record. The prior 2 years were dry as well. It's serious, but what does a drought and a drought emergency mean for Bay Area water consumers? Tonight, we have convened a panel of experts to discuss the weather outlook, local water supplies, and water conservation needs going forward. We will also take a closer look at Las Vegas, an even drier place that's in the midst of a 14-year drought, to learn what measures it has taken to successfully manage its fragile water supplies. Joining us by phone this evening are Dr. Warren Blyer. Warren is the Science and Operations Officer for the Greater San Francisco Bay Region Forecast Office of the National Weather Service. Welcome, Warren.
Pleasure to be here, Joseph.
On the phone as well with us, from Las Vegas is Doug Bennett, the conservation manager for the Southern Nevada Water Authority. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you, Joseph.
And here in the studio with me are Michael Carlin, a deputy general manager of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
And finally, Laura Tam. Laura is a sustainable development policy director for the policy think tank SPUR and the author of the report Future Proof Water, where the Bay Area should get its water in the 21st century. Welcome, Laura.
Great to be here.
And of course, we would like to invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation with your questions and comments. You can phone us in about 20 or 30 minutes at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can go ahead and email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment at the KLW's website. So, Warren Blyer, I wanted to start with you.
Okay.
So you heard our announcer saying that there's rain in the forecast here in a couple of days. Tell us, from what you understand our drought situation to be, how many of the storms that may or may not be coming in the next few weeks will we need to get out of the situation we're currently in, just to give us a sense of the magnitude of the problem?
Well, we would need a lot. You know, if we look at we tend to look at precipitation by water year, since most of it falls during the winter time, so July 1st to June 30th. So far this water year, downtown San Francisco has had a little over 2 inches of rain. Normal for this date would be a bit over 9.5. And for a water year as a whole, on average, we'd get about 21.5 inches. So we are way, way behind. More than I think could ever be made up by anything happening over the next few weeks.
And so how bad is this drought compared to ones that we've had before?
Well, once we talk drought, it makes it a more complicated issue than simply the meteorology. We're certainly very rainfall deficient, but then that gets to also gets to areas that I think your other guests have more expertise in, what our water supply is like and the availability of water resources, which also get factored into discussions of drought.
So then let me reframe the question. How does this the water year compare to previous water years?
To this date, about the lowest ever.
And
that's
going
about 150 years of records. For
okay, the lowest ever in the last 150 years.
Yeah.
And what is the meteorological explanation for what's going on right now?
Well, we've had an extraordinarily persistent and strong ridge of high pressure that's extended along the West Coast. It's kind of acted as a big persistent shield to any storm systems that would be trying to approach from over the Pacific Ocean. In a way, though, that's kind of not an entirely satisfying explanation, and that the question would then become, well, why has that been there like this year when that hasn't been the case in other years? And before you can pose that to me, I'll pose it to myself and say that we really don't have a good explanation for that at this point. That's sort of the kind of issue that people doing research in climate science are presently looking into.
Okay, so you can't really say at this moment if climate change has anything to do with the situation we're in currently.
That's exactly correct. It could be playing a role in this, but I don't think it necessarily has to be. And you know, there certainly have been with the people who look at long ago climate, so looking back hundreds of years over California, doing based on tree ring analysis, tree ring dendrochronology, there have been periods of staggering droughts by modern standards in bygone years, and those obviously occurred in the absence of human influences. In this case, and what we're seeing now, no clear answer to that question at present.
And what about the weather patterns that we've heard about before, El Niño, La Niña? How are these playing into the current high-pressure system? Does this have anything to do with that, or is that entirely separate?
Well, you know, El Niño years tend to be wet for us, and La Niña years tend to have weather, tend to be drier, especially the stronger La Niña years, and with a weather pattern not that dissimilar from what we've seen this year. But the interesting thing is that actually we assess whether or not an El Niño or La Niña event is taking place based on analysis of large-scale sea surface temperature anomalies over the tropical oceans, and in looking at those, neither has been the case either presently or over the last year. We're in a neutral state with respect to El Niño and La Niña.
Mm. And the last of the introductory questions I have for you on weather patterns, 94% of California is reported to be in a drought. Is there kind of a continuum or a spectrum of how across the state of places that are drier than others, or that are not, you know, that have nothing to do with their usual rainfall, but in general that where the conditions are more severe than others? Or is it kind of pretty much the same across the state?
Really, from a precipitation standpoint, across the state, it's been severely deficient this water year. Really, almost all of the state is in the same severe drought category. There's a little part of far southeastern California in the deserts there that's you know, classified one step milder from a drought standpoint, but that, and that's why it's 94% rather than 100%. But really, from the standpoint of the state as a whole, it's entirely significantly precipitation deficient.
Okay, so that's Dr. Warren Blyer with the National Weather Service, and we'll come back to you a little bit later in the program with some additional questions.
Sure.
I want to turn next to Michael Carlin, and Michael Carlin is with the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So how worried are you about the situation that Dr. Blyer just painted for us?
Worry is a good word. We're very concerned about it because of the lack of precipitation that we've had this winter. And, you know, we've had a couple of dry years before this. So it's a pattern, and we have water in storage. That's what saves us, and it allows us to carry forward and serve our customers. But what we're really seeing is the lack of precipitation over this past winter. When you talked about how this is tracking, this is tracking like 1977, in fact, below 1977, which was one of the driest years in California. And the good news is people use less water today than they did in 1977. So even though population has increased, the actual amount of water that we use has decreased significantly. So that adds a little bit of a comfort zone to us because we have the same amount of storage and we can serve more customers with it at this point.
And so when you look at the stores that you have available to you, you're talking about some local stores here in the city. You're talking about Hetch Hetchy. Tell us about that, the whole the pantheon of San Francisco water storage.
So we're very blessed. We have the Hetch Hetchy system up in the Sierra Mountains, and it's a wonderful system. It provides about 85% of our water. We have about 15% of local supplies down here in the Bay Area. And what's really great about Hetch Hetchy is that it's dependent on the snowpack. So when it doesn't snow, you know, we don't get a lot of water. We share the river with two irrigation districts. They have senior water rights in California. They get the beer. We get the foam. we operate very judiciously, and we're very much watching the precipitation patterns, not so much here in the Bay Area, though we like to get some rain in the Bay Area, but really what we're concerned about is the snow in the Sierras.
Because that's where the major water supply is. So when you look at the supply in Hetch Hetchy, how much lower is it than normal, and how does it compare to the local water supply that you have here?
So the overall system, even the local water supply, we have about 70% of capacity in storage right now. Typically, we would be somewhere around 80%, a little bit above 80%. And because we're at 70%, that's why tomorrow we're going to talk to our commission about our water supply outlook and call for 10% voluntary conservation within the regional water system. So that includes not just San Francisco, but our 26 wholesale customers as well.
That's right, because San Francisco supplies water to more than just itself. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Sure. We are the water supplier to about 99% of San Mateo County. We serve water in northern Santa Clara County and southern Alameda County. So adding that together with San Francisco, we have 2.6 million water customers in the Bay Area. We are the largest water supplier, municipal water supplier in the Bay Area. So we have a responsibility not just to San Franciscans, but to all our customers, and we treat them all equally.
And so you're going to ask for this tomorrow. What's your sense? Is it going to be approved?
It's going to go forward. We're now working, with our wholesale customers about messaging. I think it is the right thing to do at this point in time. And again, because we have such low water use, it's really going to play a little bit into like how do you save water, and we can talk about conservation measures that individuals can implement in your own home to help save water now that we're in sort of this situation.
Mm. And I imagine the concept of how much water do we have and how much do we need is one that's hard to get your head around. Mm-hmm. Let's just say we had no precipitation for another year at this point. For those
My heart
of you
attack?
Who cannot see him, he is clutching his chest. Just how long does the current water supply last us? I think it's important to give the listeners a sense of what that really means.
If we had no precipitation at all, we'd still have a couple of years of water supply, at least 2 years. But it will get harder and harder as we go forward because people will have to use less and less and less in order to stretch those supplies. And also, we've been developing some supplemental supplies, such as groundwater in San Francisco, some groundwater in our service area. We're looking at recycled water. All those projects will have to get accelerated in order to make it through a prolonged drought with no precipitation.
Hmm. Okay. So you've painted a pretty grim picture there. I want to bring Doug Bennett from the Southern Nevada Water Authority into this conversation. Where did you get into drought management in Nevada, which is in the midst of its 14-year drought? Where in that story did you get into this?
Well, I think right at the front end. I came here in 2000 from New Mexico, and in retrospect, we really got hit hard by the drought in 2002. But when you looked at the precipitation patterns, we realized that drought started in 2000. So I guess I created the perfect job security.
So hearing Michael at this end of the crisis here, the beginning, what kind of similarities are you hearing in what he's saying, and what kinds of thought processes would you encourage now, 14 years into that? And to the drought where you are, that we should be, what kinds of questions, what kinds of things should we be talking about at this stage, at the early stages, when we still have potentially up to 2 to 3 years of water? Some people might say, well, that's kind of a lot of water.
I think the early stage for us, and probably what also is happening in California, is first educating the public about, before they can get down to implementing all these measures, which you need them to implement, you also need to remind them of where exactly the water supply comes from. people become very detached. My water supply, the Colorado River, has its headwaters 500 miles north of us. And so when you live somewhere that gets a few inches of rainfall each year, it's easy for people to think that if we get rain in the valley, that somehow that's abated the drought, and you have to remind them that's not our water supply. I mean, that's a brief respite from water demand, but that's not where the supply comes from. So we spend an awful lot of time educating people again about where the Colorado River comes from, how it's managed, who we share it with. You know, you kind of have to sketch out for them all of the circumstances that you're operating within so that they can understand why you're asking them to do what you're asking them to do. Sometimes they come up with these real quick, simple solutions, like, you know, hey, we'll just snap and put a desal plant over here. They don't often understand what the complexities of that are.
You mean a desalination plant?
Right, absolutely. Okay. You know, we get the same thing in Las Vegas. Hey, there's this thing called an ocean. It's full of water, you know. And so you have to remind your public about what kinds of challenges there are within managing water so that they can help support some of the decisions that are being made in the community.
Hmm. So, Laura Tam from Spur, you have been doing a lot of thinking about this, and you were thinking ahead to what the Bay Area should be doing moving forward to safeguard its water supply for the coming decades. Tell us about your perspective on the current situation that we're in. What do you think, from a think tank's point of view, are the key messages that we need to get out to consumers at this time?
Well, as you know, water being essential to life, having a safe and reliable supply of water is important for the continued growth and prosperity of the Bay Area. We have about 7 million people today. We're expecting another 2 million people to move here by 2040, and all of those people are going to need water. We did a report looking at the Bay Area's future water supplies and do we have enough for the future, and how should we supply our future water needs? And looking into the future, we see many of the same impacts that we're going to have to plan for coming up really, really immediately with this drought. We see potentially future droughts, climate change, increased demand, things like that that will require us to stretch the supplies that we have, create new supplies, or manage demand. So I think with respect to the current situation, we have a lot of planning tools in place that we're thinking about for the future, some of which we can accelerate into the immediate term. I think what Michael said earlier about conservation and efficiency and what you can do is a critical first step. Many water agencies in the Bay Area have found that just by asking, they can get 10 to 15% of water conserved. And in a place that's got enough storage and can get through this dry year, that means a lot. Many water agencies plan for a longer term drought than the one that we're already in, so we would expect to be in a pretty good position in most places to weather, no pun intended, this type of this situation we have this year. But looking forward, if it were to continue, if we're to have a deeper drought that lasts longer, happens again in a few years, we're going to have to plan beyond the 10 to 15% conservation measures that we hope to be able to get immediately this winter.
And I would like you to talk a little bit more later in the program about some of those measures that we
Absolutely.
Can put into place in the long term. But there's a lead-up time, right, to getting those things in place. How many years? A decade or so before you can get some of the suggestions that you've put out?
I would say, not necessarily on the demand management side. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can get conservation. You can improve efficiency almost immediately. And many of those same programs are things you can do actually save people money too. So there's no sense hesitating in implementing those types of savings. But in developing new water supplies, such as even new recycled water, executing transfers and agreements, storing groundwater, doing things where you manage water from wet years and put it in the ground to use it for dry years. You have to have some wet years first before you can do that. So it does take many, many years to site, to plan, to permit, to go through the public review process and the political process to do any sort of new supply project. So I would say 10 years at a minimum, but Michael may disagree.
No, actually, I don't. I think it does take about 10 years to bring a new water supply project online. we're fortunate that we've been planning our groundwater project for the past 10 years, and we're at the point now where we're going to go to construction at the end of this year. We're fortunate that we are in the planning stages of our recycled water, and we're also doing a conjunctive use project that Laura talked about with some of our wholesale customers, where we give them extra wet year water, they stop pumping the groundwater, and then we can pull that groundwater out in a dry year. And that project's getting close to being approved as well. So it does take a decade or more, but you'll see a lot of like people saying, why don't you accelerate? Why don't you move faster? And we're going to try and do some of those things.
So it sounds like increasing the supply, as important as it might be, is a strategy that's going to take a lot of years of planning and politicking and negotiating to get to. So demand moderation or demand management, as you call it, is where we're at in the present day. So tell us about the kinds of things that you're going to be recommending to consumers, Michael, that they do at this early stage.
Well, I think Doug actually made a good point. First is just branding. Where does your water come from? So people actually know that it's coming from someplace and the source is somewhat limited. But things we're going to talk about doing is much the same we've done in the past. There are things like taking shorter showers, not washing down your sidewalk, use a broom. Make sure you fix all the leaks in your house. As Laura said, it saves you money and saves water. We have programs for high-efficiency washers, and you should always fill your washing machine to capacity before you run it, just like your dishwasher. Don't do half loads. That waste water. We have a program where we'll come out and do an audit in your house to look and see where you can be more efficient. And the interesting thing is, like, you know, everybody thinks all the toilets are efficient, but we actually have a program where in multifamily residences in San Francisco, because they're not homeowners, they're renters, they don't think about the toilet, but a crisis like this will start getting the owners calling us about rebate programs to do large buildings, and that really saves a lot of water.
So this is an important question that I was wanting to get out on the table early on. I think it's important to understand how much can any one consumer contribute to this cause of demand management. And when I say that, I'm thinking about the water use across the state and thinking how much our agricultural industry uses in terms of water. So when you pit those two things against each other, how much does conservation at the consumer level can it really do compared to what can be done at the agricultural level? Who wants to take that question?
Well, I'll say that, I mean, yes, agriculture is a much larger user of water across the state than urban water users, but urban water users are responsible for the fastest growth in water demand. So if we are doing things in urban areas, residential water use and commercial water use, if it's being wasteful in any way, that water's not being used to grow food. It's just being wasted. So we could do more in urban areas to sort of level off our demand curve. We've actually done a lot of that already in San Francisco and probably in other places, as Michael alluded earlier, where we have a growing population, but we've had an overall decline in water use. That's a great conservation success story, but more things like that to help sort of level off the fact that more people will be moving to urban areas and demanding water to try to keep that demand flat going forward is a good strategy.
Michael, do you want to add to that?
Sure. I think one of the things is that when you look at per capita usage in urban areas, it actually is going down. People are using less water. And it's very easy to get them to use even less water when they start thinking about it consciously. So that's always a good thing. The second thing is agriculture is moving towards water use efficiency. So they're trying to get more stretching their supplies because of the different types of crops they're growing now than they have in the past. You don't have a lot of like hay or things of that nature just being grown, but more high value crops, more food crops. And the third thing is that basically I think I would see that you can't forget economic growth. It's not just the people that live here, but they want to come here and work here. So you got to think about the economic engine that makes the Bay Area what it is today. And all the people that come here, live here, and want to work here, how do you want to keep that going?
So, right. So the question there is, could this drought affect the economic upswing that we're in currently?
It it definitely has a bit of a chilling effect on it, but I think that's one of the things when we actually look at how you can conserve water. When you look at a commercial building, 90% of the water in a commercial building is for non-potable uses. When I say non-potable, it's not for drinking water. It's for flushing toilets. It's for sinks. It's for this. It's for that. But there are ways that you can actually build smart buildings these days. We actually have one. It's our headquarters building. We recycle our water in the building to flush the toilets, the urinals, and we use 60% less water than a building of the same size. And we're 225,000 square feet.
Mm-hmm. And Doug Bennett, I wanted to talk to you again about how you get consumers to embrace some of the things that that Michael mentioned, like shorter showers, not hosing down your sidewalks, fixing those leaks, getting water conserving appliances, getting someone from a utility commission to come in and do an audit, not washing your car perhaps. What kinds of incentives, what kinds of gimmicks perhaps even have you used to get consumers to kind of embrace this in a whole scale level?
Well, again, I think just educating our consumers and generally moving them as a community toward these measures, I think, was really useful. But both San Francisco and Las Vegas are world-class cities, but they're very different. So San Francisco is a very dense urban environment, and certainly indoor water use changes can make a big impact in that sort of environment. For us, it was outdoor water use. It was people's landscapes and their backyards and the parks and the landscaped right-of-ways and so forth that were consuming the majority of our water supply. And we did some research, and we found that lawns were using four times as much water as xeric landscape, or what we call here water-smart landscape. And armed with that information, we could put a price tag on that. So we started offering people rebates to eliminate ornamental lawns and to start putting in more water-efficient plantings with drip irrigation and mulch. We've done more than 50,000 of those projects. We've converted more than 160 million square feet of lawns to more efficient landscapes. And that's saving us about 59 billion gallons of water. We also moved in 2003. We said, you know, you can't keep people from moving somewhere. There are, I'm sure San Francisco also has anti-growth advocates that say, you know, it's time to put up some kind of a checkpoint and decide who can get in. And you just can't do that in a city in the U.S. And so what we said is we need to grow smarter. We know these people are going to come, but we obviously can't have them have the same water footprint as all these homes that we're trying to retrofit. So we said, we're not going to build those homes anymore. We're going to build the smart home from square one, and we restricted the use of turf grass in ornamental uses. So if you bought a new home permitted after 2003, you would not have grass in your front yard, whether you wanted it or not. And you'd be limited to not more than 50% of the backyard being grass. And so we, rather than going around chasing people with rebates, we said we have to stop it now, and then I can go out and coax the existing homeowners to take the rebate and try and eventually get this entire city with water-efficient landscaping.
Well, Doug, we actually have quite a few lawns here in the Bay Area. And then we have this whole thing called Golden Gate Park that really survives on irrigation and used to be sand dunes. So we're actually not that different than Las Vegas in some ways. But Michael, you were nodding there when Doug was making his points.
Compliment Doug. Southern Nevada has this great program. It's called Cash for Grass. It's not the kind of grass that you're might thinking about, but rather to take out lawns. And they were the pioneers in this area, and I compliment them, and I admire them for what they have been able to accomplish there in Las Vegas.
So do you see a time when San Francisco might, not only in this current situation, depending on how long it lasts, but as part of its future planning, might go to some of these measures that Doug has mentioned?
Yeah, Xeriscape is drought-tolerant plants. You know, my backyard is all drought-tolerant plants. It doesn't need much water, if any water at all. We've also been switching out grass in some places with this type of grass that is a no-mow, drought-tolerant grass that doesn't need much water. You'll see more of that as we kind of go forward. There's not, I mean, besides the parks, there's not like huge lawn areas, but in some of the parks, we've been able to substitute some of the grasses so that they're actually more drought tolerant than they have been in the past. So I see that as we go along, but I also see recycled water coming in and actually irrigating Golden Gate Park, you know, the golf courses and things of that nature. And we've already done that at Harding Park that has recycled water. We're working on Sharp Park right now. That's going to have recycled water. And as soon as we get the bigger plant up and going, we're going to Golden Gate Park next.
Well, in case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing whether or not San Francisco and the Bay Area has enough water given the recent declaration of a drought emergency by Governor Jerry Brown. And we're talking with Dr. Warren Blyer, Bay Area-based Science and Operations Officer for the National Weather Service, Doug Bennett, Conservation Manager for the Southern Nevada Water Authority, Michael Carlin, Deputy General Manager of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, and Laura Tam, Sustainable Development Policy Director for the policy think tank SPUR. And we invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions or comments. Does the drought emergency inspire you to conserve water? What have you been doing already, and what are you willing to do now? Do you worry about the lack of precipitation? We want to hear from you. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Again, 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment at KLW's website. So let's go to our first caller. That's Karen from Berkeley. Karen, welcome to the program.
Good evening. Okay, so a couple of things. I think that a permanent drought should be declared in California. To go, it's a drought, it's not a drought. Are we going to declare a drought? When is it going to be a drought? Everybody has to know that at this point in time, they cannot hose their sidewalks down. They have to use a broom. They cannot water their lawn. They have to either convert it or get some kind of a drip irrigation system. And I think that all of the people that are as on guest tonight, including East Bay Mud and the governor, should contact all the local TV and radio news stations. And these people should have public service announcements 10 times a day telling people how much water they use when they run the sink if they're brushing their teeth, how much water they use if they just, you know, run the washing machine or if they're running a hose for their garden. I'm a water conservator. I hand water every single plant that I have. I don't flush for everything. All of these things have to be, you have to educate the public. And the best way to do it is with TV and radio. And it's great to have this discussion, but the reality is it's not getting any better and it's getting worse. And most people just turn on the faucet. You're right. They have no idea where that water comes. And I've lived without water and electricity. And most of the people in the world have to gather their water. So I think it's really great, and I think it would be good if you could get public service announcements on the news media in view of the fact that Jerry Brown declared an emergency, and I believe one of the professors at the University of California, a geologist, said this is the worst drought in 500 years. So, and I just drove down to Monterey a month ago, and normally when I drive down this time of the year, all those beautiful hills near Salinas, the hills and the trees are green. Everything was brown. So what are the birds going to do? What are the insects going to do? What are the butterflies going to do? What about the animals that want to go under the trees for shade or for their life? It's more than just water for people in San Francisco. It's everything. And that's my comment to you guys this evening.
Thanks, Karen, for painting that broader picture for us.
Thank you very much for the show. I appreciate it.
Yes. So, Laura, you have someone as passionate as Karen here. Tell us a little bit more about how you would like to see the civic conversation extend beyond people such as Karen to really get at this from a sustainable perspective, not just for this drought, but for the years to come, which is really the point of the work that you've been doing.
Yeah, it's great to hear such enthusiasm for the work that we are all trying to do, which is to save water for our state, for the people who need it, and for the environment as well. So thanks for your comments. Certainly, people in the water community have been advocating for conservation and not running the water while they brush their teeth for decades now. I grew up with that message. So I think that that's it's well understood that that's the right thing to do, as well as not to waste water for things like washing sidewalks. It makes perfect sense. And everybody needs to do their part. Fully agreed. Looking into the future, we examined a bunch of tools for reducing demand and creating new supplies. And given that we are expecting in the future as much as this type of reduction in snowpack, you know, as little as 20% of the snowpack, average snowpack, could remain by the end of the century on a regular basis due to climate change. So conservation is going to need to become a way of life throughout the state. And looking at some of the tools that we examined in our report, looking for towards the future and what we need to do to make demand meet supply, or make supply meet demand for the Bay Area, we looked at a bunch of things and rated them according to some of those same concerns that you have: reliability, cost, and environmental impact. And the ones that we rated the best in terms of what needs to be done in the nearer term are the set of measures that reduce future demand for water, as I alluded earlier, and include conservation and efficiency, green building requirements, retrofit on resale requirements, which is a law that the SFPUC and others have in place that basically says you have to retrofit your building with water-efficient fixtures by a certain date, and as well as retrofitting older buildings is a really important way to help meet reduce the water needs of existing development. And then the next things we need to do going forward are, you know, looking at new supplies that include carefully monitored groundwater or well water use, recycled water, as Michael was talking about. I'd love to see our state move towards potable reuse, which is taking wastewater and turning it into recycled or even drinking water in the future. That's currently not allowed in the state to take it to that far, but maybe it will be. There's a study underway, and hopefully in just a couple years, we'll be able to take wastewater and treat it from recycled to potable. Which is, it makes sense because that's what people are drinking right now. It's just put in the river for a little while first before people take it out again to filter it for drinking. So, and again, water banking as well, which is an innovative way of, as we talked about earlier, storing extra water available in wet years for use in dry years. So there's a host of tools we can take advantage of to move forward. But really, all of those tools are in service of thinking about conservation as a way going forward that we're all going to have to take part in.
So I want to get to some other calls here. Put out the number again, 415-841-4134, if you want to join our conversation about our drought here on City Visions at KLW 91.7 FM and KLW.org, 415-841-4134, or City Visions at KLW.org. We have one line open. Let's go next to Patricia from San Francisco.
Thanks so very much for this wonderful show. I work for the Department of the Interior, and we are extremely cognizant of drought. As soon as the governor declared drought, the bureaus in the department really are swinging into action. We have the Bureau of Reclamation and Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Park Service, all of which manage water and resources, and we're extremely interested in doing more with less. But my question is actually twofold. I live in a part of San Francisco that has tremendous, enormous construction, and I would like to know if you feel comfortable that all of these apartments and condos going up are as water efficient as we could possibly make them, and if they are metered for water use, because I understand that about half of the city of Sacramento is not yet metered for water use, and if you don't meter it and track it, you're never going to be able to control it.
So, Laura, do you want to start there?
Sure. Sacramento, I think, is in the process of metering all of its connections, which is definitely a best practice in water conservation and something that is necessary all over the state. And we already meter all our connections in San Francisco, as I understand. Michael can correct me. But in terms of new growth and apartment buildings, I would say that actually new growth in compact development is actually much more water efficient than development that occurs in a more land inefficient way, large lot, dispersed suburban development. As we were talking earlier, large lots are responsible for about an average of 50% of household water use nationwide. So if we can direct more of the Bay Area's growth to compact places where people don't have to have lawns. They generally don't. They don't necessarily have to have a car to wash. And living in sort of compact apartment buildings, those types of units are much more water efficient as well. They also allow for shorter transmission systems, reducing leak losses, and basically lessening energy needs for pumping and pressurization. Basically, extending ratepayer dollars even further to. Ratepayers' investment in existing water delivery infrastructure.
So what you're saying is increasing the density of San Francisco is not necessarily anti-water.
Not at all.
That's correct.
Okay. Did you want to add something there, Michael?
There's two things. One is building efficiency is actually regulated by ordinance in San Francisco, and we work with the Department of Building Inspection. So buildings going up are actually much more efficient than older buildings in San Francisco. The second thing is we spent $70 million automating the meters, the water meters in San Francisco. Every building has a water meter, and every water meter actually gets read every day four times. It gets uploaded to our main computer system, and soon every customer that has a water meter will be able to go online and see their water use. And when you think about this, we can tell, like, if there's a leak, if your water's running all the time, there might be a leak, we can notify you. But it's also, you know, people can look at how efficient they are. When they put the one on my house, the team came back and said, gee whiz, did you do laundry last night? And I did, because they could actually see the spike in water use in my house in the evening. So that's another little tool people can look at. How much water am I using during the day? And what activities am I doing during the day to use that water?
So once you start measuring the water, of course, the next question becomes, are you going to start charging people differently for the amount of water that they're using?
You know, we actually do have tiered rates here in San Francisco. So we're very conscious of, economically disadvantaged people that have large families. And so we tier the rates a little bit. It's an upward tier of rates. So the more water you use, the more water and more you pay. So if you conserve, you pay less. So that's actually another conservation management tool, is actually just using pricing as a signal to the consumer of how much water you can actually save and how much you'd save in your pocket as well.
So in all, any of your suggestions to the commission, are you going to suggest that the tiers be tiered up, so to speak?
We're not going to tier them up at this point in time. We're actually going through a rate study right now, and we do this every 5 years, and we'll be taking that to our commission later this fall to talk about what the next set of rates should look like over the next couple of years, and we will take the current conditions into account as we do that.
And what do you think about that idea of increasing?
Tiered pricing is a great way to get people to conserve water, because as you use more, you have to pay more. So there's a built-in incentive into the rate structure to only use as much as you need. The more tiers, well, I don't know if I would say the more tiers the better, but certainly having more than two tiers would be a good practice, I think. And pricing is a tool that can be used to help curb or diminish marginal demand. So it's definitely a good practice. There are some places in the United States that have the opposite rate structure, where you actually get a discount for using more and more water, and that's the opposite of what we'd want to see.
And Doug, in Las Vegas, have Las Vegas and Nevada used the pricing structure of water to impact water use?
Right. We also use an increasing block tiered rate structure. So it tends to be those more luxury uses of water cost you more than your basic requirement. What I really like what Michael's saying is about these new metering technologies and being able to give customers same-day feedback on their water use, to literally be able to log in or look at your smartphone, because even though the bill gives people feedback, it gives it to them a month after they used all that water. Hmm. And when people can actually see that something's going on in their home, or even be able to use an application to predict where their water bill is headed, how much it might be at the current rate of consumption, those are, I really feel like, the next wave of tools. People are responsive to that information. Many of us have a car that tells us how many miles per gallon we're getting right now, and it has a big impact on our behavior, how hard we press on the accelerator. And I think that feedback, instantaneous feedback, is going to be the next big tool.
Michael, do you imagine giving rebates to people who decrease their water use significantly?
I don't think we're going to go that far yet. But
let's go to our next caller, JJ in Sunnyvale. JJ, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. TJ, actually. I first wanted to observe that for myself, I've been collecting my rinse water from my kitchen sink and using it to water the plants in my balcony. More recently, I saw on Facebook a friend comment that he collects his rinse water and puts it in the toilet tank, which I've started to do. And I figure I'll add some of that blue agent stuff, whatever, to maybe help keep the tank clean. But it's one way to make more use of your rinse water. And then I wanted to ask, what's the status on subsidizing measures to make big agriculture, if you will, more water efficient? I seem to recall in Arizona, at least, that they've had a program to take agricultural land out of production or more water efficient in order to free it up for urban use. And it seems like something we could be doing here if we're not already. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's a great question, and part of what's happening right now in these current water conditions is large agricultural districts are looking at fallowing land, actually large acreages of land. If they're a junior water right holder, especially if they're a contractor with the State Water Project, which the governor's announcement was directed at, or a Central Valley Project contractor, which is run by the Bureau of Reclamation, They are looking like taking land out of production. And I'm not talking about a few acres. I'm talking about tens of thousands of acres as we kind of go on in the water year. It also doesn't necessarily free up any extra water for urban use, but, you know, water transfers that will occur will probably be from agricultural districts to urban centers. And we've been in discussions with some of those agricultural districts, and it's very hard to convince them that this is the right thing to do, given that they're short of water as well.
I wanted to interject one thing here. You could have a whole series of shows on water rights, but I'm curious, how do droughts impact water rights, or how do water rights impact what we can do during droughts? Anything you can say in a nutshell there, Michael? Because it's a pretty complex web, isn't it?
It's a very complex web, and I will say this: in the governor's announcement, there was a little bit something buried in there that only us little water jockeys kind of looked at. It basically stated that the State Water Board, who actually oversees water diversions in the state of California, can modify anybody's diversion during this period of time.
Wow. So it does open up.
It opens a big question of, like, maybe they start saying, you can take some water, you can't, or and things of that nature.
So water rights are not water proof? No, whatever. They're tight, whatever they are. but the question then becomes, beyond this drought, do you see this, do you see the water rights negotiations reopening? I'm curious, because we've lived with these water rights for a very, very long time, and they haven't really been touched.
I think it always calls into question then, do we need to reform the system? Because it doesn't make it very easy to go through these kind of situations and still honor the water rights system. Of course, we in San Francisco have a very ancient water right, and we'd like to see it honored. But we also need to consider, like, what happens in the future. And this is the big debate about water in Southern California, water for agriculture, water in those areas that Laura talked about, where they're, you know, using their land maybe inefficiently as they spread out on big lots and things of that nature.
Okay, let's go to some more calls here. We have John in San Francisco next. John, welcome to the program. John, are you there? Hello, John? Okay, I think we...
Jeff.
What's that? Oh, Jeff?
Yes, this
oh,
is Jeff.
Sorry, Jeff. I got your name wrong. Jeff, come on. Go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to follow up on an earlier question, and that was the situation regarding water that's used for agriculture, and I wanted to follow up and continue the discussion, because to me, that seems to be the elephant in the room, because 80% of the water in California is used for agriculture, roughly, And so while we can, you know, use all these great methods to improve our conservation in urban areas, the bulk of the water conservation really needs to be on the agricultural side. And so I wanted to hear more, you know, about that topic, and also discussing, you know, basically efficient irrigation techniques that could be employed on a more mandatory basis to avoid flood irrigation of crops, and also walnuts and other, I guess, almonds and other crops that maybe are not really the most important crops that we should be focusing on.
Okay, thanks so much for your call. I'm not sure if our guests can speak to that. Michael, do you want to?
You're right about the percentages of water use in the state of California. Agriculture does use the majority of the water, but also they actually have been getting more efficient over time. And they're going more to drip irrigation. They don't do field flooding as much as they used to. In fact, it's going away. They've also taken a lot of their open canals and put them in pipes. So why I'm kind of, you know, supporting those efforts on their part is because they eventually will have excess water they can make available for urban use. And so that's when we talk about water transfers. That's where the water is going to come from. Efficient farming practices will free up water that can be used in these kind of situations and also for the long-term growth, as Laura talked about, for just population growth in the Bay Area and the rest of California.
The key to all of that, though, is policy, Joseph. There's not a lot of incentive for a farmer to do those types of things on their own, because often any water conserved goes back to the irrigation district. And unless that irrigation district has some kind of an agreement to provide that water to another user and there's some money in the mix, there's not a lot of incentive to go invest in these more efficient technologies. And so, again, an exciting thing going on in water policy is the ability to start doing banking between agencies, where somebody can contribute an amount of water they're not using to a bank, somebody else is able to borrow that water, lease that water, buy that water, transfer that water, and it's really starting to connect the supplies in the West. For example, Nevada right now banks water with California, so through our conservation program, the water that we're not taking, we're able to bank with California and then call for that water in the future. It benefits California when they need that water. And it benefits Nevada because we otherwise might not have a place to put it or store it. So it works very similar to the bank where people are depositing their money and writing their checks from. When you get a home loan, sometimes you're borrowing a lot of other people's savings accounts, so to speak. And this water banking, the policies are evolving very quickly, and agriculture is going to play a very big role in that.
Okay, thanks. Let's go next to Ed from Berkeley. Ed, are you with us?
Hi.
Yes.
Hi. Great program. It might be a good time to think about banning fracking down in Monterey. What do you think about that?
My guests don't seem to want to comment on that, but what do you want to say about it?
I mean, we certainly do need water much more than gasoline. You can't argue with that.
Point taken. Thank you for raising it, Ed.
Hey, nobody's going to comment? That's amazing.
I won't talk to fracking in particular because I'm not an expert on that, but I guess one of the challenges when you start saying that a certain economic use of water is not acceptable anymore is you sometimes have a difficult time figuring out where to draw the line. I mean, here in Las Vegas, everybody wanted to point at resorts and golf courses because they're so visible. But the reality is resorts and golf courses combined were 15% of our water demands, and a lot of that water use in the resorts was non-consumptive use. It was water we could reclaim and reuse again. And so everybody wanted to point at what they thought were good and beneficial uses of water, and I think it's a very slippery slope thing. Really what we said was whatever people are doing, whatever those economic uses and beneficial uses are, we need to cut the waste out of them. Whether it be irrigating a golf course, running a resort, watering your yard, washing your car, we just have to find the best ways to get them done. And what I like about that is you're not putting tens of thousands of people out of work and making frivolous decisions about who has the right to use the resource. You're just telling everybody no one has the right to waste the resource when they do it.
Except this is a new use. This is a new use of water. They're trying to phase in, so maybe we should question it.
I think questioning it is definitely appropriate. I'm no fan of fracking personally, but certainly, we should be cautious of using a drought as a political tool for other purposes. There's going to be enough challenges with moving water around for people to drink, let alone for discussing many other uses which are important. So we need to kind of keep our eyes on the prize and focus on conservation and efficiency in all sectors, from urban to agricultural to industrial and various commercial uses, and use the tools that we have, metering, pricing, and other things, to make sure that we're getting, I hate to use this metaphor, the best bang for the buck, but maybe that's really the right approach.
Okay. Let's go next to William from Belvedere. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Something has not been dealt with. In 1976 in Marin County, a moratorium was placed on new hookups. They calculated how much water they had, and they said with the amount of water they have, and the supplies that they just can't have any more water meters, no more hookups, that's it. And then they found other sources of water, and so they took away the moratorium. On the other hand, Bolinas found the same finding in the 1970s, and they put in a moratorium on hookups, and there hasn't been a single hookup since then in 40 years. So if indeed, as we have in Marin, a fixed supply of water at this time, then, as they say in the...
Are you still there, William? We missed the punchline there. Sorry, William, for thanks for your call, but I'm going to have our guests respond to this idea. We talked about it a little bit earlier with the construction in San Francisco and how that's impacting putting on more demand on water use, but seeing that densely growing cities are actually more water friendly. But any thoughts, Michael or Laura, about this idea of getting to a point of no new water hookups?
It's a good question that came up in 76 and 77. I think the thinking that we have now is actually we are looking ahead and we're developing additional supplies. That's one thing. But we've also been much more efficient on the actual use of water, so it has gone down per capita. So again, the point is we have more people use less water. And one thing people don't realize, we actually plan for droughts. We model for it. We have a design drought that we use, and it's over 7.5 years of not having a lot of precipitation. So we are actually much more prepared than we were in the past for handling these kind of situations. And so 76, 77 caught everybody by surprise. 87 through 92, if it didn't rain in March, we would have been in a lot of trouble. But now we're much more focused on how we can manage our supplies, and we've diversified our supplies. And as Laura said, you know, groundwater, recycled water, even looking at potable reuse is something we're all considering now that we didn't consider back in 76, 77.
Yeah, and going back to what I said previously, be cautious of using water as a political tool. When people say we can't do any hookups, we don't have the water to sustain any new hookups, oftentimes they're not telling the truth. It may be that they're using that water as a tool to prevent new growth or to prevent development, when, as we know, we have become more water efficient as a region, as a state over time. And water agencies plan for 5 to 8 years of drought. It's something that they do as a regular business practice. So we would not expect to see a dry year like this prompt any cries of no new hookups, and that to be a realistic statement.
Okay, and let's go to Pat from San Francisco. Pat, you get the last comment here.
Okay, could some of your guests please just address briefly the whole idea of the bottled water? We can't just say, okay, we're not going to use our city water anymore. We're all going to go out and buy bottled water.
Ridiculous.
I hope no one is saying that.
Do you know how cheap your water is that we deliver to your house each and every day and how pure it is and such? You can't buy enough bottled water. In fact, you can't even buy a bottle of water for the same gallon that we deliver to your house. It costs you about 10 cents for us to deliver a gallon to your house. How much does a 16-ounce bottle of water cost? $1? So it's not a replacement. You need to conserve every little drop that you can. In fact, you should not be using bottled water. You should actually just be drinking tap water in a reusable bottle to be sustainable.
Yeah.
Great. So as we bring this hour to a close, I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of our callers. Thanks for calling in. Michael, I wanted you to let us know how consumers can follow the Public Utilities Commission's plans as we move forward into this drought.
So you can go to our website. It's sfwater.org, and we will have conservation tips on the website. And you can contact us through the website if you're a San Francisco resident to have a water audit of your residence. We will have information that we will be sharing with our wholesale customers. And if you're living in one of those areas, such as San Mateo County or northern Santa Clara County or southern Alameda County, you can go to some of the water districts there, and they will have similar information, and you can contact them. And to be water wise, and I would say be water wise throughout the Bay Area. There's a lot of other water districts. East Bay Mud was mentioned, Contra Costa Water District, Zone 7 out in Alameda. All are great agencies. Contact them and be water wise.
And last words from you, Laura, where people can find out about more about what SPUR is thinking about water conservation moving forward.
Absolutely. We have looked at a bunch of different tools in both demand and supply management, and we've evaluated them for reliability, environmental impact, and cost. And you can read how we weigh these different supplies and what we recommend for the future at our report, which is entitled Future Proof Water, and you can find it at spur.org.
And that's City Visions for this evening. I want to thank our guests, Dr. Warren Blyer of the National Weather Service, Doug Bennett of the Southern Nevada Water Authority, Michael Carlin of San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, and Laura Tam of the think tank SPUR. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Bob Summer. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join my co-host David Onick next Monday as we look at the future of California's high-speed rail. This is Joseph Pache. Good night and have a great week.